Hey, did you get a shiny new tech device for the holidays? Great. There are dozens of NPR podcasts just waiting for you to explore on iTunes. You'll find independent journalism, game shows, and stories that can take you places you never expected. Just search around for NPR podcasts and enjoy your holidays.
That was terrible.
I'm Stephen Thompson, and this week's episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour is going to sound a little bit different. I'm here in the studio with Linda Holmes.
Hello, Stephen.
You know, I feel like the student has become the teacher, and I am hosting just this moment.
It's true. It's true. So this podcast will be the first half of our live show.
Our live spectacular.
Our live podcast-o-spectacular.
Very good. Thank you.
I don't know if you know that word.
Did you just come up with that on the fly? That's incredible.
I did. Podcast-o-spectacular.
And it sounds different every time you say it.
It does. And so this will be our first half, and it'll sound a lot like a regular show.
Right. This is a special live episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour held in front of a wonderful studio audience at Studio One at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
It's going to sound a little different. You're going to hear a different energy in the room, but try not to damage your headphones when your mind is blown.
Try not to be incredibly unsettled.
So thank you and enjoy.
And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor.
Don't make noise then.
I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And on today's show, we will be looking at a couple of year-end topics, things that we are interested in from the past year. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, here in historic Studio One at NPR HQ here on North Capitol Street, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover Mover.
We can't take that.
That happens.
Movers
are covered by him.
That happens at least twice a month.
I cover movies and theater and pop culture ephemera of all kinds.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, the first thing we thought that we would talk about today is a segment that we're calling Time Machine. As we get to the end of the year, one of the themes that emerges is... This is your fault. Kersey McGee. Did you mention Hamlet? Or is it Macbeth?
It's Macbeth.
That happened because I'm a genius. One of the themes that has emerged in our conversations is that culture is in a lot of ways relative. It looks really different to you based on where you are in your life, who you are, what's happening, what point in your life you're at. And so we're trying to get our arms around that idea by looking back at 2013 and asking what if we came to 2013 in a time machine from, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, what would surprise us the most about the popular culture that we saw and how we related to it? So, Glenn Weldon, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Mine's a little conceptual. But
what a shock.
I'm gonna start with the fracturing of the monoculture. And I can say
too bad
that
this is water.
I can say that a little less pretentiously, I think. My parents loved Stephen Eady. Let the record show that a lot of hands went up with lighters as soon as I mentioned Stephen Eady. Everybody's chanting, summer, summer, wind. No, that didn't happen because you're toddlers and you don't know who Stephen Eady is. They were, in the 50s and 60s, a singing couple who sang standards from the Great American Songbook. They were non-threatening standards, sung in a non-threatening style. And my parents loved them. But this is the thing. They would never consider themselves fans, because fans, to my parents, meant something different than it does to me. Fans to them meant the Bobby Soxers who rooted for Elvis and screamed for Elvis, and that's not what normal people did. And they would never go to see Stephen Eady at the Valley Forge Music Fair, for example, Linda Holmes, because, you know, live music.
You know, he's bringing that up because that's where I saw Jack Wagner, and
exactly.
I really resent it slightly. I should say it's one of the places I saw Jack.
But they wouldn't go to see live music because live music was for beatniks. But yet, Yet, they didn't need to consider themselves fans because the culture of the time, the monolithic culture of the time, served them up giant honking slabs of Stephen Eady all the time on Carson, on Bob Hope specials, on Dean Martin roasts. And I saw this and I think, okay, this culture is my parents' culture. It's targeted to them. I am outside of it, so I'm going to have to go and find my own thing because I was a maverick. I was a loner, Dottie, a rebel. But the monoculture is now dead. Happened this year. I don't know if you missed it. And it was killed by the internet because the internet breeds niche interests, right? It nurtures them, and we have to, and it forces you to consume culture less passively than they did. They would turn on the television at 7 o'clock at night, turn it off at 11. In between, we'd soak in culture very passively. Now, when I say we have to seek out culture and we're more active now, that the action that's required is you going like this. So it's not really like, let's...
doesn't burn calories. It's not that kind of action.
But being in that niche culture, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but that being in that niche culture is misleading because it feels like you're still part of the monoculture. Still, because you're just seeing and talking and reacting to people who feel about exactly the same way you do.
So you're in a silo.
Exactly. So one of my niche interests is I'm a comedy nerd, right? So
you don't say.
Yeah. So I was watching a couple films this year. Hell Baby. Anybody see Hell Baby? Okay. Niche interests. My very point. What about Kings of Summer? Anybody see Kings of Summer? All right.
You got more on that one than Hell Baby.
I know, right?
That was closer to a smattering, than a clap.
In both of those films, the comedian Kumail Nanjiani has a tiny little bit part, a cameo, but he knocks it out of the park. He's very funny. And so when he came on screen, I would turn to Faust and go, hey, Kumail Nanjiani. Exactly the same way that my parents would go, hey, Don, Stephen Eady. It's exactly the same thing. But it's not just Kumail Nanjiani. It's Kristen Bell. It's Adam Scott. It's Ken Marino. It's the entire cast of Party Down. Amy Schumer, who got a great show this year. Nick Kroll, Paul F. Tompkins. All these people belong to this, what is actually a very niche culture, but feels is misleadingly what feels to me like monoculture. What do we think of that? Throw that open for discussion.
So your sense is that the same way that the monoculture fed Stephen Eady to your parents as they desired, the niche culture that you are part of serves you all the Adam Scott that you can.
And it happens. He just pops up in things, and I get that same feeling, even though I now have to seek out things like this.
But I mean, part of it is a product of the fact that the things that were cool, like underground, outsidery things 10 years ago, were observed by the people who are now executives at studios that are making these things. I mean, a lot of the decisions are being made, and I'll get to that in what I'm talking about shortly, but a lot of the decisions that are being made by like 41-year-old nerds.
Exactly.
Like somebody...
That's right!
That was not nearly enough applauding. We know who you are. And who we are, we didn't applaud either.
But you know, that if you're of a certain age, like your generation and the people who stand out in your generation get to, I mean, like I love the series Mr. Show. I've talked about Mr. Show a million times. Everybody who was on Mr. Show has been in like every comedy thing ever because the nerds who write those shows watched Mr. Show the same way I did at that age.
Absolutely. So it feels like it's targeted to me in a way that I never thought the culture at large would be. And it's not. The culture at large isn't, but this one thing that I've chosen, it very much is. So that's my...
So Glenn Weldon says, Adam Scott is my Stephen Eady.
Yeah, it's Kumail Nanjiani is actually...
Kumail Nanjiani is my Stephen Eady.
But he gets in there. He sneaks in at the back end.
Glenn Weldon. I like it. Stephen Thompson, you were just talking about what you thought you were going to mention, so let's hear it, buddy.
Well, yeah. I mean, whenever we do a Tiny Desk concert at the NPR office, I send out the little announcement and with a bunch
little.
Of... Little? Sometimes they grow increasingly long. Sometimes they contain an essay. And I was doing one for the band Superchunk, or maybe it was the Dismemberment Plan. Maybe it was one of the 800 bands that were popular when I was young that are suddenly coming back now that I'm old. And in this little essay, I was writing about this phenomenon of how, like, My Bloody Valentine, You talked about if you stepped into a time machine from 1993 after what's going on with my hair, the first question I would have would be, My Bloody Valentine just now got around to releasing an album because it took 22 years. Yeah. And so in this little essay, I was talking about how this phenomenon of, you know, what is going on? You know, Sebado released its first album in 14 years. David Bowie's first album in 10 years. Black Flag is some twisted version of Black Flag is back. And what is going on? And what I finally concluded in what I was writing about either Superjunk or the Dismemberment Plan, I don't remember, was that us of a certain age, are squinting at the dying embers of our generation's cultural relevance.
All right, then.
Because
just
when you
the way it's meant to be.
Because when you think about it, now part of it is we are somewhat among the last people to have bought albums. And so it would make sense that some of the bands that appeal to the last people who bought albums, that catering to that market would make a certain amount of sense. But there's also the quality that, like, these bands had better get on the stick because eventually you're going to be like, does anybody, this is the Steve and Edie of early 70s soft rock, but does anybody remember the band America?
Yeah! That is surprising. No.
There was a lot of people who like America. I'm just like, a horse with no name? America released an album in 2007, and it was like their first album in like 20 years. And I remember thinking, too late. Had you done it when, you know, the big fans of America were squinting at the dying embers of their cultural relevance, it might have done a little bit more. And so just this year, for me, what jumped out was just how many of those bands grabbed on to that, you know, that, I mean, suddenly there's new music by the Pixies, mm-hmm. you know, for the first time in 20 years, you know. I mean, even some of the shorter gaps, like Daft Punk was 8 years, you know. So it just seemed like everybody who you ever wondered if they were going to put out a record, except for Dr. Dre, put out their album. I just got a press release saying there's a new album coming out or a new tour or something by The Rentals. Like, that is for like 80 nerds my age, mm-hmm. and no one else. Mm-hmm. So
now I know what you do with the press releases that you get for people other than former American Idol contestants, which you send to me.
Yeah, usually those I just forward on to you.
Yeah, like, you do.
It's John true. Paul Stevens.
Yeah. It's true. Well, mine.
That was an American Idol deep cut that like two people got.
Yeah.
You know, he was a red-haired crooner. here's what I've been thinking about. I was actually doing pieces of the job I'm doing now a lot earlier than I thought I was, because I sort of have my own origin story, which is like, well, I wasn't doing this job until, you know, relatively recently. And then I remember that in 1993, when I was a college student, or roughly 1993, I wrote a paper about the role of women in movie musicals.
Story checks out.
Which is pretty much what I'm doing now, right? I mean, I wrote about the fact that, for example, there are a lot of movie musicals. We can go very, very deep on this later if you'd all like. But, like, for example, there are a lot of movie musicals that feature a women dancing around in their underwear number, which is sort of surprising. Like, Oklahoma has one of those, and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which has other problems, has one of those. And so I wrote this paper, and I realized that I was interested in these questions even at that time, but that I would have been surprised if I had forwarded to now. I would have been surprised to see that
people would read that paper.
That it would still be in some ways such a mess, right? That I would still be writing about, in the middle of the summer, this total absence of movies with women in them, but that by the end of the year, you would be looking at The Heat and Catching Fire and Frozen and Gravity. Really four movies in sort of buddy cop, big franchise, animated movie and prestige drama that are fronted by women and that really are, you know, both critically and commercially successful. So in a weird way, even though it's still such a difficult and uncomfortable issue that I write about all the time, both because of that and because I'm surrounded by this really vibrant community of women writing about culture, who I realized that if I tried to name a bunch of them, I would short a bunch of people because there are just so many who I read all the time, that I would feel actually better about it, even at the same time that I sort of obsess over being unhappy about it. So it's kind of this odd conflict of like that I would still, that would still be such an area of interest and I would still be so conflicted about it.
Is it just that there's a critical mass of people now talking about these issues? Is that one of the things that you're reacting to?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of what I'm reacting to is the content of like these movies this particular year that really seemed like they were starting to push that issue of like, I don't want to hear anymore about how nobody's going to go see it if it has a girl in it.
Right.
Even though Frozen was marketed as like the Wacky Snowman movie.
Yeah.
No, it's true. It's true. And Gravity was marketed as much more of a duet movie than it actually is. And, you know, but both because of the actual content and because of the kind of community of writers who write about this stuff all the time, that I do feel, you know, both better about it and worse about it. And I guess it's that I would feel pulled in both those directions is sort of what would have surprised me when I was writing about, like, well, here's all these musicals where the woman is singing about this and the man is singing about this, and, you know, because even as a college nerd, that was already an area of interest.
Yeah.
By the way, I neglected to mention when I was talking about the soft rock band America that on their Wikipedia page, where it's referring to their attempted comeback album, it, quote, went all the way to number 52 on the Billboard. This made me smile. I didn't want to leave it out.
I was going to say, I'm glad that made it off the Unabomber notes and into the air. Trey Graham, how about you, buddy?
Well, one of the things I was thinking about, in part because I knew a little bit about what you were going to talk about, is the changing role, the evolving role of women creatives behind the scenes of these projects, right? And that got me thinking about something different. Since the challenge here was to find something about...
You're going to talk about the Kanye West video for Bound 2?
I am, actually. More the parody. But yeah. No, since we were sort of charged with finding something about where we are now that would surprise a visitor from the past, I wanted to highlight an example of what I feel in my gut has been a real sea change about a particular kind of story. I was really struck earlier this year when I was watching, I think it's the third episode of Orange is the New Black, which involved the character Sophia, who was born biologically a man, and the character Crystal, who's Sophia's wife. It's a flashback scene, and Sophia has put together an outfit, and she goes to show it to Crystal, and they have this conversation.
You look like Hannah Montana. That skirt is...
I thought it was so cute. That's what happens when I shop for myself. It's because I never got to be a teenage girl.
And you never will be. You should be dressing like a classy grown-up lady.
You think I'm classy?
I can't have my husband walking around like a $2 hooker.
The mix of savvy and humor and charity in that exchange just really kind of laid me low, and it made me realize that it feels to me like some of the best told and most popular stories in pop culture right now, from Orange is the New Black to Scandal, this hugely popular thing, to the Broadway-bound musical If Then, which is trying out at the National Theater here in town, they're telling the stories of LGBT people. Especially trans people, and sometimes bi people, and sometimes people of a fluid gender identity, and people who aren't necessarily prosperous white LGBT people, in a way that is just vastly different from so much of what's come before, right?
Yeah.
And I think, to tie it back to what you were saying and to my idea about women in the creative suites, I think it's probably not at all a coincidence that two of the examples I just named are from... or it's women-run
women
projects,
creators.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe, in the back of my head, I think there are kind of areas of congruence about the way women move through the world and the way LGBT people are often forced to move through the world. There's a curiosity and a kindness and a humanity in the way these stories are being told now that I'd never sensed before. It's like... And it's part of something that's bigger in the culture at large, I think. There's been such a sea change. And these are stories that still make people
some people very uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and we don't talk about the politics of this, but as a cultural thing, it just feels very, very different to me, the world we're in now. It's like there's more and more of a sense that these stories are about people,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and that they're real stories.
I was very glad that you highlighted that conversation, because I think, and Stephen and I think had the same reaction when we heard that conversation, which is, oh, boy, that was so good, and I'm glad that you reminded us.
Yeah, to me, it's not just that those stories are being told and that those voices are being heard, but that the stories are being told so well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That to me, I'm so glad you highlighted specifically the third episode of Orange is the New Black, which to me, personally, was the best hour of television I saw this year. Mm. I was absolutely floored
Better
by
than
it.
Football?
Well, no. Actually, there was an hour of the NFL last week that was just unbelievable. The end of Ravens Vikings was unbelievable.
Well, I think...
I know, right?
I deserve that.
With sexual minorities recently, but with minorities in general, it seems to me that sea change you're talking about kind of goes from being reviled to being mocked to being pitied.
Patronized.
And then mm-hmm. deified, briefly, yeah, very,
right.
very briefly.
right.
And then...
There's a show called Sean Saves the World.
Exactly.
Right.
And then matter of fact. And it takes so long to get to matter of fact, but we've gotten there for a lot of these issues you're talking about. Yeah. I think we finally gotten to matter of fact. We just got to cling to stay there.
Yeah. Yeah.
White-knuckled.
So Orange is the New Black, it's Jenji Kohan, right,
yes.
is the
mm-hmm.
the writer, the showrunner. That episode, directed by Jodie Foster.
Fascinating. Wow. Thank you, Trey Graham. Well, no, that was great. So because sometimes I like to organize episodes in ways that sound good when I say them, but confuse us wildly in practice, where our first segment was called Time Machine, we're calling this segment Time Capsule. And it sounded like such a good idea. It was like, this makes sense.
We're brilliant.
There's parallels.
Segway.
And then we realized that all week we were like, wait, Time Capsule or Time Machine? Because this was my mistake. So in Time Capsule, what we want to talk about is we do want to just do a little bit of a year-end wrap and think about what are the things this year that if we were putting something in a time capsule to both kind of say something about the year and also just be worth listening to or reading or watching or enjoying, what would we put in there? Let's see. Stephen, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Yeah, you know, I was really jumping around on this one, just trying to pick the exact right artifact, because I really did try to think of it as a time capsule, an object. So you know, it certainly you could have gone with What the Fox Says. You could have gone with the Miley Cyrus at the VMA.
The Fox Says. That's easy.
Yeah, I also heard that too. I was going to let it go.
The same thing.
I do not know what is wrong with you.
Yeah.
That is terrible that you would think I would say something like that.
Stephen, it was very close.
There is actually no lie. In the musical If Then, there is a song that Idina Menzel... It is called What the Bleep.
All right, fine. I just think, I don't understand why you would think I would say that, given that I never swear.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So, What the Fox...
Continue.
Continue. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize.
And ultimately, I finally decided, again, I wanted a physical artifact, because I think we were talking about 50 years from now, that we would put this in a time capsule, it would be opened in 50 years. And I think we can all agree that in the year 2022, long about there, the internet will experience a catastrophic collapse.
Sure.
thus wiping out all information that has not been written down.
Oh.
So I wanted to sing the praises of two things, and I've talked about them a little bit on the show, but I thought they had both had a very important year in very similar ways. And it's two books, talking about books.
Ooh.
Who's got layers? I wanted to talk about the books Why Grizzly Bears Should Wear Underpants by Matthew Inman, who does the webcomic The Oatmeal.
Right.
And, of course, Hyperbole and a Half, Hyperbole and a Half, Unfortunate Situations, Flawed Coping Mechanisms, Mayhem, and Other Things That Happened. How much I hope that they are saved and preserved as so much more than... the way people often think of things they see on the internet and laugh about and send to their friends and then forget about. Because I think that part of what is so interesting about both of those strips and how I love the idea that they represent the future of their respective, a lot of what they are, of comic strips, of mm-hmm. blogs, is that they're so personal. And particularly in the case of Hyperbole and a Half, they're coming from very deep, dark places. And Ali Brosh had sort of an unbelievable, wonderful rise in 2013, where she had done a webcomic on depression in, I believe it was March of 2012, and then disappeared for 14 months, didn't do a new strip, and came back with this absolutely searing and soaring and wonderful piece called Depression Part 2. And, you know, shortly, not terribly long thereafter, a few months thereafter, this book is coming out, and it's a mix of some of her classic strips, including the first Depression piece, and then a bunch of new materials. I believe she calls it 10 and a half new stories. And I love the idea of that material being, you know, preserved, and obviously, you know, we've talked about how, you know, how many things are going digital, and how, you know, what is the future of compact discs or books or DVDs or anything. And I'm just really glad to see these bound and saved and treasured, and to see these people accepted and understood as incredibly serious and important artists.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you, Steve. And Trey Graham.
If we want to put one thing in a box for people to discover in 50 years, I nominate the epic unraveling of Cate Blanchett in the movie Blue Jasmine. The nerviest, most committed performance I have ever seen her give, and I have seen her in a lot. I would hold that performance up against anything in the canon as an example of absolutely in-the-moment, nerves-exposed acting. She's just so fascinating to me. She's got the chops and the discipline to do all this various work across genres and forms. And I've seen her live on stage in Chekhov and Tennessee Williams. I have seen her in films like The Aviator, where she's playing Katharine Hepburn, mm-hmm. and then Pushing Tin, where she played a New Jersey housewife married to an air traffic controller, and was so completely transformed, both in manner and accent and hairstyle, that when I saw the trailer, I did not recognize her. I literally did not recognize her until the names came up at the end of the trailer. Even stuff like the Lord of the Rings pictures. She, like I said, the chops and the discipline to be really, really focused on just delivering in every single thing she does. And Bob Mondello and I were talking earlier today, and he thinks, because he just watched Blue Jasmine last night, so I was like, here's my theory, here's what I want to talk about this afternoon, what do you think? And he's like, she gets Best Actress this year. And I'm just going to say flat out that she is one of the greats. She is just a massively talented and intensely intelligent actress.
Sure, but do you take off points or do you put an asterisk next to it when a performance blows the rest of the movie away, as I felt her performance in Blue Jasmine did?
I don't think you blame her for that. I think that's the director's problem.
Really?
Yep. I thought Sally Hawkins was terrific.
Because that certainly happened with Meryl Streep and whatever Meryl Streep just won an Oscar for, right? You know, I'm sorry. I needed to narrow it down further.
Was it the Thatcher?
The Iron Lady, right?
The Iron Lady.
Yeah,
the Iron Lady.
The
Margaret Thatcher movie.
Yeah, that movie was terrible. But
but she's amazing.
No, I know what you mean.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Blue Jasmine, because to me that did signify one of the major moments in the year, particularly in cinema, obviously, where it represented this instantaneous change that happened this year, certainly in the way movies are covered, where we went from, we were all, like, everybody who was writing and talking about film was talking about, are all movies terrible now? You know, where we were all like, Pacific Rim, fighting right. robots don't make me. And yeah. You know, we reached summer blockbuster fighting robot fatigue on our show.
We reached peak robot for sure.
We definitely reached peak cities being destroyed.
In a big way.
And then all of a sudden, there were a lot of all these discussions about how now all movies are made to play around the world, and they all follow the exact same formula. I mean, the fact that like Star Trek Into Darkness and Man of Steel had like almost identical, you could just overlay those stories on top of each other. And then all of a sudden, Blue Jasmine came out. There was a film festival is basically what happened. Blue Jasmine, 12 Years a Slave, suddenly Gravity's coming, and then it's like, it's a golden age! And so it spoke to the gnat-like attention span of people who talk about culture.
Yeah, and when Stephen and I first talked about this, one of the things I said to him is I think I think that the large quantity of culture writing that there is has resulted in kind of a compulsive temperature taking, mm-hmm. where people are kind of constantly trying to figure out, where are we? Where are we? And you can only ask, where are we, so often,
right.
before it becomes like, well, not in that different of a place than we were 2 weeks ago. You ask, where are we? So, you know, I don't know. But I agree with you. I think it's a good one.
I'm very smart.
You are. And you never swear on stage. Glenn Wellman.
I had a little tough time getting my head around this one because I also wanted to.
My fault.
No. It was just that I wanted it to be an object too, if it could possibly be, and not go conceptual. But then I thought, like, it has to be a piece of an artifact that will last for 50 years. A
love.
And and then I thought, okay, so it needs to be like a packed with information that will last. So it can't be any part of technology because, like, who's going to play a DVD? How will we know when they play DVDs in the future? So I thought maybe like, and we also didn't talk
driving around in their hover cars.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't talk about the size of this time capsule, so I wanted it to be compact. Say about
so not enough data is what you're saying.
No, yeah, I just wanted it to. Well, okay,
is it large enough to contain Mount Rushmore?
So maybe like these rough dimensions.
Oh my God.
I'm just saying. For this those weight,
should we explain?
For those of you listening at home,
yeah.
Glenn is holding a package that's roughly the size and shape of his book.
Okay, so a book. That's a good idea, Trigram. So we choose a book of some kind. But you know, I think the real answer is, well, the question is what book. And I think it should be, like, we're just, you know, it's a shame that this year wasn't some kind of milestone year in pop culture.
Right.
When a long-standing character, I'm just picking things out of the air, a long-standing popular culture character had some kind of major anniversary.
Right, right. And a major motion picture.
Or, for example, that.
Sure. A terrible, terrible mainstream motion
picture. Yeah, well, also that. No, just kidding, this is a little joke. This is my book, it's out.
It's a joke.
This is going to play great on the radio.
I know. What I would actually put in there is this. This is my smartphone. I would put it in there with the intention that it represents what happened in this year, what this device is doing to the art of conversation. And I say that and I can feel like a cardigan forming on my body. And Kleenex sprouting from my sleeve. But hear me out. Conversation that happens between small groups of friends is, it rests on a convivial, communal cushion of bull poop, right? It's not facts. It's stories. It's anecdotes. It's memories. It's opinions. And these are not a series of data points to be fact-checked. And yet, if you go out with a group of friends, and there happens to be, I'm not dinging you, I'm just saying if there happens to be a millennial at the table, and somebody mentions in passing a movie, and then you see out of the corner of your eye this happening. And then this happens.
Glenn is typing furiously with his thumb on his phone. Radio
audio.
People.
Thank you, audio yes. Podcast.
Then they show the phone to everybody at the table, 2003. Film was made in 2003. Nobody asked if the film was made in 2003. Nobody cares if the film was made in 2003. But because it is a data point that can be retrieved, it is retrieved. And what I'm saying is that the truth that happens at these conversations, Linda Holmes, the truth...
Roll on, old man.
The truth is not analog. The truth is analog. It's not digital.
Whoops.
So I would put this in, and I would load it up with the app Freedom, so they see how absurd we've become. The app Freedom, you may recall, is the app that turns this device, which is engineered to connect you with the internet, into a block that cannot connect to the internet. I would also load it up with a lot of trend pieces, a lot of articles recently, about this phenomenon called phone stacking. Does everybody know what phone stacking is? Phone stacking is a game that you play when you go out to dinner. Everybody puts their phone on the table face down. The first person to lift or check their phone pays for dinner.
Oh, I've done it.
Well, see, this is the thing.
You probably paid for dinner.
Trigram, if we were to go out to dinner, you would be broke.
Yeah.
You would lose. Yep. I would come in second. You probably next. I think probably Stephen, unless you're kid.
Sorry. Parenting.
But that's what I would choose. a cell phone to show what's become of conversation.
In cell phones invented in 2013. Yeah. This is a big year for this.
We're
cell
at
phone.
A nexus. My point is a nexus.
I like it. Well, when I was looking for time capsule choices, I thought a lot about what I wanted to include because there's a lot of great art that came out this year, and I thought maybe, you know, a great show, maybe the Breaking Bad finale, you know, maybe some great movie. I think they're still going to care about 12 Years a Slave in 50 years. So I thought about a lot of different things, but what I ultimately chose was this.
There's a kid in the middle of nowhere who's sitting there living for Tony performances, singing and flipping along with the Pippins and Wickets and Kinkies, Matildas and Mormonses. So we might reassure that kid and do something to spur that kid, because I promise you, all of us up here tonight, we were that kid, and now we're bigger.
As many of you may perhaps know, that is the opening number from the 2013 Tony Awards in June, performed by Neil Patrick Harris, because that's the law, and a cast of gazillions, with a song written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who did In the Heights, and also Tom Kitt, who wrote the music for Next to Normal. And the reason I chose this is that, when you cover pop culture, you spend a lot of time looking at how much it's changing, how much it's, you know, digital distribution changes things and different forms of filmmaking change things. And there's all kinds of indie experimental stuff that I love. And there's kind of weird animation and, you know, all kinds of things are happening that are different and that are exciting and odd. But I would never want people to get the impression that in 2013 we didn't still have that. And what that was a theater full of people who saw a bunch of live performers sing and dance and jump through a hoop and kind of execute that kind of fast patter song and do this great kind of one-time-only theater number. And when you watch the audience in that TV clip, they are just completely enthralled. And the performers at the end, I cry every time I watch this clip. I cry every time I watch this clip. I get goosebumps and I cry. Literally. That's not like I cry. I cry. I did it today.
I'm the same way about most clips of most things.
I would never want a time capsule not to represent that as much as everything changes and everything does change, at least in 2013, much to, I think, everybody's benefit, we still have that. We still have a room full of performers and a room full of people and the ability to generate that kind of performance energy. And I think it's important to remember that as much as stuff changes, we still have that. So that's what I picked.
Yeah. Good one.
And that has absolutely nothing to do with a desire to suck up to live audiences at all. And that brings us to our final segment. We're going to do a quick round of what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, I hope we get a chance to talk about this movie on the podcast because, of course, we are coming up on award season and suddenly when all the good movies are coming out in the span of like 2 weeks.
It's a golden age.
Suddenly it's a golden age, it turns out. And a movie that I absolutely loved. It's sort of rolling out very, very slowly. By the time we put this podcast up, it'll be almost out. I'm sure those of you who have read year-end top 10 lists have probably heard of it. It's called Her. Written and directed by Spike Jonze, who did Being John Malkovich and Adaptation and films of that nature. And it is very much in the spirit of those films from a standpoint of you can't imagine how they can possibly execute this plot, which is, namely, as many of you know, Oh, for come on.
Just. As long as that's a branded pint glass, that's fine. Go on. Happy face, McGillicuddy. Light on.
So it stars, as many of you know, it stars Joaquin Phoenix as a Nebbish of the future. It is set in presumably designed to be the fairly near but future, who falls in love with an artificially intelligent operating system voiced by Scarlett Johansson, as all artificial and such systems would be.
Right.
It is some of the most eerily realistic and thoughtful science fiction I have ever seen. And it is wonderfully imaginative, and I walked away from it, first of all, immediately wanting to see it again in order to puzzle out more of what it's trying to say. But the undercurrent of this movie is that virtually everyone in it is so used to having their immediate and very specific needs met that they have really no ability to, like Glenn here. It does tie in a little bit.
I meant it was connecting to what he said before.
You were doing a little callback there. No, talking about what Glenn was saying before, that our needs are met so specifically that when we are put in contact with another person in any kind of intimate way, whether it's a relationship or a friendship or whatever, it's very difficult to understand and process the needs, the very specific needs of other people. And so the relationships in this movie are all very subtly, it's all subtext, but the relationships in this movie are all sort of bound up in that inability to communicate in a fascinating way. It's a wonderful picture. I just love it. I sometimes find Joaquin Phoenix a little remote, and you know, the Master to me felt very much like an acting exercise with all these wonderful performances that I didn't feel. And this was a movie I really felt. I love it. Her. It's kind of, I believe it's opening wide January 10th, but it is wonderful. One of my favorite movies of the year.
Thank you, Stephen.
Was it Spike Jonze who made that beautiful little short about the robot?
Yes, I believe it was.
I don't remember the title of it, but Google.
We'll do the research.
Oh, well, Spike, you know what? Jones. We're having a conversation. We should just check on
ourselves. Yes, we'll check everything.
We're not doing it.
But yeah, it was like maybe 30 minutes long, I think. And just this gorgeous little sort of grainy Instagram filtery short movie about two robots falling in love. Is that right?
It's
gorgeous.
His stuff is
full of heart.
His stuff is very thinky, but it's also full of heart.
Yeah. All right. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
What you said in your last segment about live performances and live audiences sort of informs this pick. 1 week ago today, as we sit here recording this, I was still on my first gallon of Diet Coke when a man in a Santa suit wrapped a tuba around himself and started honking out these low, fat, juicy, low notes that are a big part of what make a New Orleans brass band such a special thing, right? It was 10:45 on a Tuesday morning, and the Preservation Hall Jazz Band was in this house for a Tiny Desk concert. Now, I have seen some amazing people play the Tiny Desk. I saw Adele play the Tiny Desk a few years back. I was there just last month. The classical tenor Joseph Calleja played a Tiny Desk, and it was profoundly moving. He's one of the finest singers in the world. But the Preservation Hall Jazz Band put on what has to be the single most joyful performance I have ever been lucky enough to be in a room with. Ari Shapiro, Bob Boylan, in the room with big fat grins on. I think Victor Holliday was swing dancing with somebody. And what was making me happy then and now is that as of, I think, December 21st, you will have access to it too. I hope that you will watch it over and over and over. I promise you it will make your day.
It was amazing.
The analysis that I would have to add to that is that you can watch and download Tiny Desk concerts at nprmusic.org. Free video podcast.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three new comics series that have recently launched, all within the last 3 months. The first one is called Sex Criminals. Hear me out. It's by Matt Fraction and Chip Zdarsky. This is a very fun book about sex among and for adults. It's great. Check it out. Black Science by Rick Remender and Matt Scoria?
Don't worry, you don't really need to pronounce it.
I don't know. This is a book that just launched about an iconoclastic self-educated scientist whose experiments in dimension hopping go very, very wrong. This is gorgeous visuals. This is panels crammed with big ideas. This is old-fashioned science fiction done really, really well. Black Science. And finally, Velvet by Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting. The conceit of this book is what happens when Miss Moneypenny goes rogue. It's not Miss Moneypenny, actually. It's because of rights. But it's an analog. She's framed for the murder of one of the 00 agents, and she must trust to her skills, and turns out she has a lot of them. So that's Velvet by Ed Brubaker and Steve Epting. So, again, Sex Criminals, Black Science, Velvet, all of these are available at comic book stores. All of them are available. You're going to have to look for Sex Criminals because iTunes does not distribute it, but there's other ways to get it. All of them are available online. They just started out. Now's the time to get in. Those are great books.
Excellent. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. When I sat down to think of what was making me happy this week, you have to keep in mind, we taped a show last night for this week. And so I had to come up with something that made me happy then. And then we were planning for this. And then I was worrying about the weather. And frankly, I got to the point where I was like, I don't think I'm going to come up with anything. So then, fortunately, a couple hours before this show, Glenn accompanied me over to the CVS. And
where you discovered cough syrup.
He accompanied me over to the CVS, and while I was trying to cross everything off my shopping list, Glenn pointed out to me, he said, "Oh, look, Miley's tongue through the years."
Miley's tongue and, through the years.
And he showed me this magazine, which you can't see it on the radio, but it's called Yikes. Oh, yeah. What it says up here is yikes. Yep. And what it says down here is Miley's tongue through the ears. This magazine cover also has the headline, "Your phone fails," and then the quote, "I FaceTimed from the toilet."
Mm-hmm. Yep. Indeed it does.
And it has some One Direction stuff going on here with it says hilarious 1D fan fiction.
Yep.
Oh my.
And so, as soon as Glenn showed me, yikes, I said, "Well, Glenn, that's what's making me happy this week."
Yep. Nice.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow our producers Lauren McGaughey at L McGaughey, MIGAKI, and Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your live head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Hey, are you still listening? Is it because you got a shiny new tech device this holiday and you're still figuring it out? There are dozens of NPR podcasts just waiting for you to explore on iTunes. You'll find independent journalism, game shows, and stories that can take you places you never expected. Just search around for NPR podcasts and enjoy your holidays.